Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff.
McClure. There, I did it in my radio voice, in the words that you used to use. Are you satisfied?
Well, it's a sort of radio voice. It really wasn't a properly cheesy radio voice.
I could go into the Sunday voice.
But there you go, but it's not Sunday, it's Saturday.
No, but... If you use a cheesy radio voice, it's always Sunday. And you can't just say like it one this. Time.
You talk way down in your chest when you use your radio voice.
Yes.
You sound very resonant.
So we are the Personal Wealth Coach, even though we do talk about cheesy radio voices. We also mostly talk about economics, bad puns, really bad humor. It is the dreary science, and somehow we are laughing about it. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We are going to talk to you today about economics in general, personal finance, what's happening in the market, in the economy, all that good stuff. But in the beginning of all that, you can't hear us talk about stuff without first telling you not to believe anything we say.
That's correct.
It is disclosure time, although the disclosures actually say...
Ta-da-da.
They don't say anything about not believing us. They do say things like, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, which is not just the name of this program. It's also the name of a firm that's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission as an investment advisor. So what does that mean? It means we as the firm, when we're not on the air, do fiduciary investment advice. What does that mean? In the best interest of the client. Well, we're registered with the SEC. What does that mean? Well, it means that we filed papers. It does not mean that the SEC has somehow anointed us with their pleasure. They don't do that. Anybody that says that they are approved by the SEC is saying something incorrectly. The SEC has a policy of non-approval. That's if anyone ever says a government agency approved of me and they're not talking like auto tests for crashing, it's probably a lie. So, what is fiduciary? Fiduciary means in the best interest of the client. It means the one word English definition is steward. I like that definition probably the best. But we can't be a steward for all of you on the air because we don't know all of you. And even if we did know all of you, if we did it on the air, we'd be violating privacy horribly. So what are we doing instead of fiduciary advice on the air? We're doing education. We don't pay for this radio program, and we are not paid to do the radio program. Town Square Media and their predecessors going back to four different owners on KTEM have asked us to keep doing this program for some reason. They just like the gleam from our bald pates, I guess. But what that is saying is we don't pay nor are we paid to do the program. However, we do buy advertising on the radio station for the radio program. So does KTEM. It's kind of a mutual marketing thing to say more people need to know about this. I'm not sure what that represents, but I think it's a good idea for you to know if there's anything funny going on. What we're saying is this is not paid commercial advertisement.
Basically, if you wanted to take this 2 hours in the morning and you wanted to pay KTM a lot of money to take the 2 hours, they'd probably kick us off the air.
Yeah, that's true. I think more than probably. I think they would say, yep, let's do it. Because
I'm sorry. It's been nice having you guys. Bye.
They will get paid more that way. Anyway, those were my disclosures. You've got some too.
The information we report on this radio program, which is educational, of course, and not advisory information.
Wait a minute. I just said that.
I know I'm repeating a disclosure, but that's okay. The SEC does approve of repeating disclosures.
Okay.
The information that we report on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. There, I said it.
You did say it. But you made no warranty or guarantee that it was accurate what you said.
That's right.
All right.
Nothing we say is warranted or guaranteed.
And we guarantee that.
We could say past performance is no guarantee of future returns. Shares may be higher or lower when bought than when sold.
Yep, we could say that. But we won't, because that would be a waste of our breath. But we did say it, saying that we wouldn't, that we could say it.
But it's interesting.
We would be talking this hour about something that I've been hearing a lot about lately. People have asked me a lot of questions about this, and that is about inflation. I kind of want to take some time on the very basic nature of what inflation is, what are the alternatives to inflation, what causes inflation. Not that I will come anywhere near touching all the causes, but just a concept. What is this? Inflation is anytime you find yourself paying more for a product that hasn't gotten any better than it was. And that's one way of looking at it from a very, very micro perspective. If you're buying a tire and it has a higher price now, then you can save money on air because it's pre-inflated. No, it doesn't work that way. I wish it did, but tire inflation is a double-edged sword. Nope, mixing my metaphors. Sorry. So the concept here is anytime you wind up paying more for something, even though the thing isn't better, it's not better than it used to be. Why should I pay more than I used to for it? Well, the answer is that other prices went up that you didn't know about somewhere. I'm going to kind of scope out. We talk about the supply chain, and that's really not a good word for it. It's more like a weird web than a chain. There's really no way of looking at it. I mean, just think about a machine screw, just a little screw, one from your computer. It might have enamel on it to make it black. It might have been chemically treated to make it black, or it could just still be silver. Well, it was probably polished to make it silver. So how many hands do you think it passed through to be in its final shape? And if you start thinking about that, well, it didn't start out as a screw, obviously, but it didn't even start out as the metal that the screw is made of. That's some kind of an alloy. That's a mixture of ores from probably completely different countries to make, you know, however many things go into that alloy. Sometimes 8 different metals, sometimes more can go into an alloy. And that could have come from 8 different countries. And then it had to go to a foundry somewhere to make it into the metal. Then that metal had to go somewhere where it would be made into screws, either through a machining process or a molding process. There's some machining that takes place. Was it done at the same place as the computer? Probably not. So you can see there's a complicated web just for the screw. One screw in your computer has traveled thousands of miles before it even gets to the place where it's going to travel more thousands of miles to wind up wherever it is that you are when you buy it. Thinking of that web that goes out, all of the parts in your computer, parts, the final parts made in lots of countries, but each of the parts that make up the final part made in lots of countries, it's spread all over the place. So this concept of one piece of that puzzle, the Bolivian trade in zinc or the Canadian iron, any connection change from a mine to a transport hub to a foundry to any one of those spots can have a delay in it, or all of them could. So first off, supply chain should be some kind of supply web. And you should think about that massive, like, radiating pattern, almost like broken glass, going out from every piece in every product that you own. When people talk about a supply chain snarl, we really don't have a bad problem. When you think about all the problems that could arise in this web that we have, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't fix it. Please don't. Anybody that's listened to me for very long says, that's absolutely the opposite of what I'm saying. We need to get it fixed. We need to get it better. And it needs to be less complicated. So this is one factor where inflation is, it's just primed. All it takes is enough screws being late and enough products become more expensive because the demand for them is going up and the end product's not available. We don't have enough screws to hold it together yet.
And I am keeping to the screw mentality because I have a few of them loose in my skull compartment. And I figure every time it rattles around, it's a reminder for me to talk more about screws and shortages and that sort of thing. It's right up there with marbles, except I've lost all my marbles. Supply chain issues. Sorry. Okay. So if you think about what is inflation and how, is it really inflation if the price went up because it was, there were fewer people in Canada mining the iron that made the screw that, you know, is that real inflation? Yeah, it's a price hike for the same product. Okay, so labor shortages can cause that. Transportation shortages can cause that. There's a lack of iron. We don't know where to find iron. Well, that could cause it. So if you think about from the supply side, and there's a group of economists that are all about the supply side, then you can flip over to the demand side. Well, we have more money now, and we want more stuff. At the same time that the supply side is going through its issues, the demand side is being funded. So it's not only being funded, but there's a lot of innovation that's occurring, new products coming out, things that didn't exist before that we have to have. And this causes this creeping, rising demand of, I have been without and I want more, at the same time that we have the other side. Okay, so inflation, we've got that pretty well kind of laid out as the subject. Supply issues, demand issues can cause inflation. What are the dangers of inflation as opposed to the other side of the coin, which we haven't even talked about yet, deflation? Because if you have one, you got to have the other. If you pump up the tire, you can deflate the tire too. And that's when money's worth more. You can buy more. You can buy the same item that hasn't gotten any worse for less money. And most people would look at that and say, well, that sounds fantastic. Give me more of that. Here's the problem with a systemic deflation. It's really bad for anyone that has debt. If you have a mortgage and we have consistent deflation over the life of your mortgage, which there's an oxymoron in those words by the life and mortgage. Mortgage means death gauge. So over the 30 years of your mortgage, if we have consistent deflation, that means over the years, the money's being, it's worth more and more. So you don't have to be paid as much because each dollar you get buys more things. So they start lowering your pay. And you think, well, that's all right because the money buys more, except that you entered into a contract for your mortgage payment that doesn't care what your payment for work is, doesn't care what deflation has done to the power of the dollar. You have a contract. You're obligated to pay the full price. So deflation is a lot more dangerous for the middle class. It's about the same level of danger for the lower class as inflation. And then upper class, deflation is actually fantastic for people that already have money, which tells you something there, that the Federal Reserve's job of keeping just a small amount of inflation is to prevent concentration of wealth. There's information in there that you can unpack for days on that subject. Okay, so we kind of established deflation is bad. Inflation is bad, but deflation is a lot worse. Hyperdeflation, there's just really nothing good that comes out of that. There's not a lot of good that comes from hyperinflation, but it's easier to recover from hyperinflation than it is from hyperdeflation. The Great Depression, where people were stuffing money in their couches and their mattresses and so on, the stories of that anyway. It's because they didn't, one, trust the bank, and two, the money was worth more the longer you held on to it. So it caused less money to be spent, which caused prices to drop, which caused less money to be spent because it was worth more. So you follow that. There's a cycle that takes place. Anytime we're talking about money, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about cowrie shells, salt, Bitcoin, or dollars, it's about confidence. The money is worth what we believe as a group it's worth. It is a true democracy, only it's only represented by those that hold the dollar or the whatever the currency is that you're talking about. So if a lot of people holding the dollar think it's worthless, then it will become worthless because they will accept prices that they wouldn't accept if they thought the dollar was valuable. You follow what I'm saying there? If suddenly everyone thinks the dollar's not worth anything, then the price in dollars would jump up drastically into this really, really high level, and people will go, oh, the dollar's not worth anything, so you need a lot of them to buy it. That's pure confidence there. That's completely separated out from supply and demand. Just your belief in money, that it exists and that it's safe, causes the money to exist and be safe. Enough people believing the money is unsafe causes it to be unsafe. It's a confidence thing. And I know this is weird, but what does money represent other than our belief? It's a piece of paper, and it's only belief that allows us to say this paper is the same value, or in most cases, not even paper. This blip of electronics in my bank account is worth that physical computer. Well, we think it's worth that. Well, that's the thing, is that when you say, what is this worth? And somebody says, I think it's worth, that's confidence. That's our belief in the value of something. And it's everywhere. It's the only way that we can keep this running. And I've told this story before about the old county fairs and how the scale that was used, the licensed scale at the county fair or at the Baron's Fair, any of the licensed fairs in medieval Europe, was called the fair scale because it was at the fair. And everybody measured their goods using the fair scale. Now, something very important to understand about the original fair scale is that it was weighted against you. It was weighted against both the person selling and the person buying because the Lord got a piece of it. So a fair scale that we use, you know, the whole word fair, the way we use it today comes from this concept, comes from an unfair concept. Just remember that next time someone says, is this a fair deal? It's confidence. The reason why they use the fair scale is because all parties had confidence in it. That's what made it fair. Not that it was equally weighted. It was the belief we all agree, and therefore this makes it fair. So inflation runs like that. And we tend to go without inflation for a long time as our confidence grows that, hey, we're going to have great sales at the end of the year. Things will be worth less than what they are now. So we'll buy it then and we'll have a big Christmas. Versus flip back to the 1980s, early 1980s, and you were trying to buy your Christmas presents in March because surely the Cabbage Patch dolls were going to triple in value by the time we got, that was inflation. So this is not a foreign or too hard to understand concept. If you're feeling excited about going out and buying stuff, that's inflationary. If a lot of people are feeling excited about going out and buying stuff, that's even more inflationary, especially if there's fewer things to buy and more money to do it with. So now that we've talked about the concept of it, it's pretty clear that supply chain issues are the fundamental reason why we're seeing prices go up right now. Very clear. It's hard to get the items. People are willing to pay more for those items because they're hard to get. And we've got enough money on hand. I can see in anybody else that's capable of looking very far into the management planning future, a time when there's going to be more things. So more manufacturing facilities opening up. We talk about the computer chip as the number one issue in the supply chain shortage. Knowing that the goods shortage is likely to calm down, knowing that the stimulus payments are likely already calming down, both at the Federal Reserve level and at the governmental level. That says that the too much money and too few good things are temporary. Now, the temporary, how long is that going to last? And will our confidence change during that period? So that's that other piece. If we have a long enough period of inflation that we all change our minds and say this is what we should expect forever, then we'll just believe it into existence. And that is a normal thing to have occur in the history of money. So even though right now I'm saying looking ahead, looking at just these numbers, we can say we shouldn't expect to have sustained inflation. If we keep believing in sustained inflation, we'll get it. I don't see us moving that direction yet. I'm not seeing people saying, forget sales at Christmas, we're going to keep the prices the same or raise them, like what we saw in the 70s and 80s. You may see some prices go up, but so far, all the prices that I've seen go up come with squirming and lots of pain from the people that raised the price based on, oh, those expenses that keep rising that make it more expensive to get this product to the buyer. Soon as we start seeing them raise prices just to raise prices and it just being the accepted methodology, I'm going to get worried. And that comes to a key point. The John Deere labor strike. The union is calling for a massive upward move in their pay. Well, John Deere is saying this is a temporary inflationary issue. One of the major causes of inflation in the late 1970s and early 1980s was contract for labor that extended multiple years that were linked to union pay. Because when I said earlier that inflation means when you buy something that is an identical product for more money, it hasn't gotten better, but you're buying it for more money. The same can be true in a labor contract. If you get a raise when you haven't shown better productivity, you're doing exactly the same work that you did last year and you get a raise. Now, we're not seeing that in the United States economy, just to be clear on that. We're seeing the opposite. We're seeing productivity growth much faster than raises. This is fantastic. This is another factor that tells me that the work ethic and productivity are going to nix inflation right out of the building. Just know that that strike that's taking place at the John Deere plant is one of the things that we're still watching anyway. Because if there's enough of a feeling, and this is a big strike, it's a strike that many of the workers look at it as John Deere's really making more money, they're not raising our wages, and our cost of living is going up. The problem with it is that the contract goes way into the future. It doesn't just cover this short period of inflation. It may include no inflation in the future. And if you mark a set of raises every 2 years into the future for a given period of time, all the pay is linked to that contract, then you're obligated to pay people more even if they haven't made more, even if they haven't done more. So John Deere is not signing the contract and the union is saying, but look around at the prices. Prices are up. So they have ammunition for this kind of strike, and they really haven't had this kind of ammunition for a strike since we had inflation, big inflation last. It's really easy to look at management and saying, you guys are keeping all the profit when prices are coming up like this and you're not passing it on. One of the things that I think is important is that union and management folks need to actually get together and say what they're trying to accomplish long term, or you might wind up with big bankruptcies again, like General Motors and Chrysler. Ford was nearly there. When union contracts have no qualifiers, no reason to do anything but just keep giving us more money, it's putting nails in the coffin. You can't compete against people that don't have that obligation. The only way you can compete is by having better quality. And there was a time that being in the union might have meant better quality. Now it's kind of iffy. Maybe, sort of, probably not. Even in some cases. So the reason behind unions, labor laws have stepped in a lot of cases and said, hey, you can't hire kids and pay them nothing. You're not allowed to put that guy over there with no shirt on and no helmet on underneath the people throwing hatchets, hammers, and broken glass. Stuff like that, you know, little things. OSHA exists to enforce a lot of those labor laws, and we have seen the union membership over the last 40 years drop drastically. And a big reason for that drop was because of labor laws. Now, I'm never going to go out there and say that everyone left to their own interests is just, they're all going to be nice to each other, and because the profit motive is a big deal, and a lot of times people cheat each other and they try to get as much out of each other as they can. It's not good business practice by any stretch, unless you're in a transactional business that you don't have a repeat customer. So if you're selling real estate or buying real estate, being as cutthroat as possible generally has no negatives to you. But if you're in a long-term relationship with your workers and with your customers. Being cutthroat means that they go somewhere else. The union management cut each other's throat concept means that they're really not understanding the concept of what they're both trying to accomplish. They both want to be profitable. They both want to do it in a way that's providing something to someone else, but they get their blinders on when they get into these negotiations as if there's only two parties involved. And management's supposed to be looking all the way around, but management's also saying, I want the new Ferrari. So, yeah. This is politics again. Most of you know this. I'm sure you got it in elementary school at some time, that politics means people. Anytime you have people together voting, it's politics, and that's just described the entire stock market. Voting with money. The stock market is politics. And I know we've just kind of taken a step away from inflation for a second, but this goes to a very fundamental point. Every time we have a presidential election, in my entire career, I have gotten panic calls from both sides of the aisle about what if the other side wins. Never had a presidential election where that hasn't been a cause of great anxiety amongst both sides. If he gets reelected, if she gets elected, if whatever, fill in the blank, and they say this is going to be the end of society as we know it, the stock market is going to plummet, and they get more anxious the closer the elections are. So not in time, but like when it's they are neck and neck. Nobody knows who's going to win yet. You think maybe, possibly somebody's going to win, but nobody really knows. It's not like the landslides of Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan in the past that we're getting recently on the popular vote. So this concept of angst and anxiety, fear, who's going to get elected and what is that going to mean for the stock market? Well, I just said the stock market is political, but it's a completely different kind of political. It's the same people that are voting in the voting booth. In fact, if you own stocks, you're a lot more likely to vote than if you don't. And that says that if we're that closely divided as a people around an election, we're also that closely divided in the stock market. And when we look at the net worth of Republicans and Democrats, we find that it's pretty even. And when we look at voting Democrats and voting Republicans that own stock, it's pretty even. So we're looking at two sides that are both have a common cause, and that neither side wants the stock market to crash. Although when you're not in power, at least you have the ability to point at the other side and say, this time it was their fault. It wasn't their fault. But you have the ability to say it. Whoever's in office is going to get the blame or the gratitude or the kudos for whatever's going on. I saw a headline about Joe Biden saying something about his policies leading to the rise in gas prices at the pump. And I'm just kind of cradle my head in my hands. I used to smack my forehead. And I'm too tired for that these days. I just kind of cradle my head and go, how does the president set the price of gas? I don't care if it's Trump, Obama, Biden. The president is not at your gas station with his finger on the button changing the price at the pump. He's not in the process of buying oil for someone. Does the president have the ability to increase the supply of oil and gas? Yes, but not very much. So tiny. And if he uses that power, it's all gone. There's nothing left beyond the day that they use the power. The strategic oil reserve can be released. As a percentage of what we use as a people, it's a tiny amount. It has no bearing. When we're talking about, let's let people go out and do deep sea drilling. We should put some leases out on the Florida deep sea drilling stuff. Let's get that going. That'd be great, except that the Trump administration released a bunch of those leases that didn't get purchased up. They didn't get leased. Because that's the most expensive way to get oil, and you can spend a lot less money in frack somewhere. So this concept that we're talking about, that somehow the president has the ability to do something with his policies to change the price of gas or the stock market or whatever. Donald Trump was very proud of his stock market career up to the point when the pandemic hit. And then he was very upset because there were a lot of reasons that he gave saying that it's about the pandemic. If you look at the trajectory of the stock market across Obama and into Trump, there's no change in the trajectory because we didn't change how we invested. Then we had a pandemic. That was not the president's fault. Nobody, the president was not in the lab at Wuhan. I mean, I don't know why not, but for some reason, we did not send our future president to Wuhan province and have him hang out there. So whose fault was the pandemic? We can talk about handling of the pandemic, but now you're trying to prove a negative. We don't know what would have happened in any other way. So we had a very short recession. We had bipartisan action in Congress. Gasp, I know, crazy. Congress passed not one, not two, not three, but lots of laws together in a very crazy, polarized setting where in the middle of shutting down the government, we're still cooperating on a bunch of stuff. That, as much as I was disgusted by it during the time, looking back at it now, how did we get all that stuff done? So whose fault was it? Well, it was everybody's fault, but the president was in there. So the stimulus and all that stuff, President Trump can get the credit for that because he didn't veto it. And when we come up to this, Biden's going to, if we get the infrastructure bill passed, Biden will get the credit for that. When this has been the political goal of like eight different administrations at this point, and it's pretty much the same verbiage, but we're going to give it to Biden this time because he's in power. The stock market, the economy, act on their own time scale, not on the time scale of presidential or congressional elections. And that's something that's hard. It's a day-by-day political environment in the stock market where there are disadvantages that you see immediately if you vote incorrectly. So long-term investment tends to say, I'm trying to build something, and that long-term building concept is the very best part of the DC economic cycle that we can find. It doesn't happen very often, but even this year, in the middle of all of the back and forth and the bloviating about who did what and finger pointing and screaming and this squad or I'm a pro-American squad. No, I'm a pro-American squad. Come on, it's politics. Even in the middle of that, we've got an infrastructure bill that has the potential of being fantastic for our economy. And as much as there's a bunch of pork in the budget, there's a bunch of other stuff in there that generally looks fantastic. There's a bunch of stuff in it that I'm like, yeah, that's, I wouldn't call it fraud, but it seems wasteful. And as we get closer to that thing actually passing, I'll be able to talk more about what's in there, because so much of it is on the cutting block even right now. A lot of the greener portions of it are getting whacked in a very mafioso sort of way. The person that brought them in has said, hey, let's go for a drive in the countryside, to his chosen earmark. And then when he comes back, the earmark's missing. I don't know. That's what's been going on a lot. One other big piece. And it's not the trucks, because the trucks are on site. It's the drivers for the trucks. So we're running at about 60% of that needed number of almost 400,000. We're running well short of what we need. And when we talk about running the ports 24 hours a day, that doesn't bring more trucks. And the truck drivers have to sleep, and they're regulated on when they sleep, where the cargo ships are not. For some reason, they have more than one driver on those things. I don't know. It's kind of weird. How do they turn the blinker on when they're turning? Come on. Yeah. So this concept, we're short on truck drivers. We have autonomous trucks on the horizon, but they're not here. It's another piece to this puzzle to say, I can see the solution, and I see us moving toward that solution rather rapidly, But we still have a hump of multiple years between now and then. So I would expect to see inflation continue for two or three more years. I could be surprised to see our production go up, ramp up faster than that, and have the inflation cut off sooner. I think we could actually go out to 5 or 6 years in inflation. And if you don't recognize that that's a long time, I don't know what other word for it. I've got a daughter who's 6 years old, and she has full-on conversations with me. 6 years is a long time. It's her entire lifespan for us to have inflation. So what are some tools to prepare for inflation? I mentioned a couple of those because there are things that have shown consistently to be great hedges against inflation. I'm going to give you some hints as to what has not been great hedges against inflation over the past several decades. Silver, gold, commodity-based items haven't worked a flip against inflation over the past 20 years or so. And I would highly recommend that you do it yourself. Try it. Look back at the historical prices of gold and silver and so on and compare them against inflation. They're not related. It has, gold and silver are not related to inflation at all, except in a bit of a myth. So keep that in mind. People go, I want gold and silver. That's a different thing. If you want gold and silver, there are other reasons why you could have gold or silver. You like gold and silver? Just don't expect it to be an inflation hedge. Most people that buy gold and silver as an inflation hedge don't wind up selling the gold and silver to protect their buying power. They just bury the gold and silver and forget about it. Just keep that in mind as well. Most people that buy gold and silver don't actually sell the gold or the silver at any point. That's just collector behavior. Okay, so what does work? Well, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, TIPS, this is issued by the United States Treasury Department, and there's lots of ways you can get it. Most brokerage facilities will let you do it. You can go directly to the Treasury for it. They have an original issue rate, and depending on the period, the maturity period, that rate may change as they say, hey, inflation's up or down. They may add or subtract from your interest rate. If you're looking at just maintaining the buying power of a dollar without putting it at risk, this is a good way to do it. No risk involved. You're not going to knock the ball out of the park. You're going to get what you put in back out with inflation on it. So that's number one. Number two, if you're already looking at a longer term portfolio, being extremely well diversified in the stock market, in the real estate market, those both have shown fantastic hedging power against inflation. This is something that I have said for years and years. If you look at the normal long-term appreciation of real estate, it tends to be inflation and taxes. And when we look at the stock market, when inflation goes up, you tend to have a higher return in the stock market because the companies involved there have to raise their prices to keep up with inflation. So their earnings go up with inflation too. Not across the board. There are lots of companies that fail in that. Being well diversified, if you look at what happened to the S&P 500 during the late 70s and early 80s, is we saw this in another period, you would say, that's an amazing growth rate. Except when you pull inflation out, it's a standard growth rate that we've seen for years and years and years. So there's more risk in the market, obviously. Both the stock market and the real estate market have seen a great deal of volatility at different times, big crashes, big bubbles. So this short-term money that you want to protect against inflation, TIPS are the way to go. When you're talking about longer-term money, investing it appropriately with the rest of your assets toward what you're trying to accomplish in a well-diversified way, that's far better than gold or silver. And man, I get this from people all the time about gold and silver. And my recommendation to them, rather than to have the argument, because it always turns into an argument, yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. Just go look up the numbers. I don't want to get into that again. Just go back and look up the long-term return of gold and apply inflation. And you'll find that we've got a negative return since 1982. There's no good thing to say at the same time that goes with that. Besides, man, I like jewelry. It's pretty when it has gold in it. Electronics is nice. There are ways to make money, make profits in gold and silver. It's in making it into something else that's more valuable than it was when you bought it. That's how you make a profit in anything. If you expect to make a profit by buying something and then somebody else is just going to pay you more for it at some point when you've done nothing to it, that's a collector behavior. What does that mean? It's not a bad thing, by the way. It's the same for playing cards or for comic books. Bitcoins, to some extent, there's a lot of collectors of bitcoins that never are going to sell it. They simply say, I'm not going to sell it. Just, I mean, comic books and trading cards are the same way. People get as much pleasure looking at them and thinking about what would happen when they sell it as actually selling it, and that's not why they bought it. Most people buy longer-term stock portfolios because they had some longer-term use for the money. And whatever that is into the future, I want to use it for my retirement. Most people, when they're buying bitcoins or trading cards, comic books, they're not thinking, this is going to be my retirement. Those that do, when I ask them about this, and there are quite a number of them that I talk to, it sounds almost like I feel like I'm an alien looking in on each of these groups that I talk to, by the way, to figure out what it is that what's their motivation. And when it comes to these comic books, most people do not ever have a plan to sell them. They say, when I need it badly, I'll sell it. Well, that's when everybody will sell their comic books. So what we actually see, though, is that people don't sell their comic books, that they tend to, or their trading cards, they tend to leave them in their wills, leaving grandkids or sometimes great-grandkids with absolutely no idea what to do with those things, making really bad decisions on how they sell them. So, and that is the same, I'm sure, when it comes to other collector-type items. I'm waiting to see what happens in the crypto market. If it's around long enough, if we don't have a change in how we encrypt technology drastic enough to change the whole cryptocurrency concept, what's going to happen to all the people who have cryptocurrency now that don't know when they will sell it? Well, this is something that this may be the most educational thing I can say in this entire 2 hours. A professional will not buy something unless they know why they will sell it or what they will do with it if they're not going to sell it. When a professional makes a purchase, they say, we have a need we're trying to fill. This is what we're going to fill it with. Or we must sell these items over here. In order to do it, we need to make this purchase. When a professional investor is involved, they know what would cause them to sell an item that they're buying before they buy it. And if you ask somebody that's buying Bitcoin why they would sell it, they generally have no idea because it'll go up.
We'll be back on the other side of some commercials to talk about more stuff. So if you would like to contact us, our email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these, I'm sure, very important messages from our sponsors. And we are back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure on the line with me. I have
Jeff McClure.
We are both bald, full disclosure. It's not fully disclosed when we're wearing hat that is fully closed. Just had to let you know. It's an important piece of information. Didn't want you to be surprised later.
There's an important factor in there other than too much money chasing too few goods. And that is, where's the money coming from? Is it coming through continual stream of money that's going to continue to chase the goods? Or is it a flash issue that came in once?
Yeah, a dam breaking or a release of a whole bunch of currency into the system. And that's a pretty easy answer. There's been a release of currency into the system. It's not that everybody's getting higher pay at work. That leads to ongoing inflation. This is a spike type event where you get a flood, and it can be damaging. Don't get us wrong. We're not saying inflation's no big deal if it happens shortly. It's not fun to go through inflation when everything's more expensive. Shipping costs are up. Food costs are up. Used car prices are up. House prices are up. You go around saying, what can I do? You know, lumber prices are up if you want to do a home improvement project. Plumbing prices are up. Electrician prices are up. You just go down a list of things and you see all of this increases and all of these increases in prices. There's a little bit of rosy in there too. Grocery store prices have dropped recently.
They have.
Yeah. Or at least they haven't risen as fast as everything else. As people are going back to restaurants, groceries are becoming expensive less fast, expensive slower, more expensive slower.
The critical indicator here is the toilet paper index.
Yes, yes.
Toilet paper has stabilized.
We're going to call that the TPI, the toilet paper index.
In some cases, has declined the price of toilet paper.
Yes. In fact, in some cases, we're going to say the price of toilet paper has gone into the toilet. Well, that's kind of hyperbole, that but I could a, write some good newspaper articles, couldn't I?
Bad pun.
This is potty humor.
Yes. You are a father of small children.
I am a dad joker. It is true. Yes. So the toilet paper index, which is humorous, but it's actually a pretty good reading on what's going on out there. It's not, there's not really an index, but if we watch the prices of toilet paper, it's come down. We have prices down for toilet paper. Who would have thought that this would be a major economic indicator?
Who would have thought that little silicon computer chips would be the restricting part in building trucks and cars?
Go back to the 1960s and say, the whole economy's experiencing inflation because chips are more expensive. And they'd be looking at you, huh? Yeah. Used car prices are up 13% year over year. There are people that bought their car new last year that are selling it at a profit this year, a pretty significant profit after having used it the whole year. This is not a normal state of affairs. This is the automobiles are consumable items. They have wear and tear. They should become less valuable over time as long as you can replace them. If you look at another scenario where the same thing happened, and this goes back to, is this a systemic event or is this a one-time type event? Is this a flash flood or is this a one-time thing? Cuba gave us a massive amount of data unintentionally on how the prices of used cars could go up. Because Cuba was pretty well sanctioned into embargo. Embargoed into sanctions, they were pretty well sealed up from most trade from the rest of the planet. So the only cars that they had in Cuba for quite some time in this wonderful communist system, say that aspirationally, they wanted it to be a wonderful communist system. It didn't work out the way that the dream was. But if we look at the price of automobiles in Cuba. Wait a minute, didn't I just say this was a communist system? How can you have prices for things that are owned by everyone? Well, because no communist system is truly 100% communist. There is some degree of ownership. And you have this amazing museum of automobiles in Cuba. Have you seen pictures of automobiles in Cuba? They're just absolutely gorgeous 1950s and 1960s automobiles, and that's all that they had for a long time. Those things became much more expensive over time. In order to own one of those, it was a very major event until eventually it was basically only owned by government officials because they didn't have a new stream of automobiles coming in. Can you put automobiles in a stream? I guess that's traffic, huh?
That's exactly
it. Let's get a traffic jam. Yeah, it's a
stream of automobiles.
Yeah, well, their traffic stopped. They had no new automobiles, which caused them to be much more valuable. That's what we're seeing in short term here. But I also think that once the supply chain issues start getting sorted out, we may, in a year and a half or so, see some deflation. We may see the reverse as all these companies, and this is not Federal Reserve driven deflation, not interest rate dropping type stuff. I mean, like, enough companies say, hey, it's going to be really profitable to make microchips because look at the prices they're selling for right now, that they all jump in and make factories to make microchips, which means when the microchips come out, everybody's selling them at the same time. There's more supply than the demand, and that causes the price to drop, which is deflationary. So, and I'm kind of seeing that across the board in medicine, in microchips, in automobiles. We're at a point where demand is far higher than supply right now, but that tends to reverse itself in expanding booms. And that's what we're in right now. There. That was my long-winded diatribe against and for inflation.
If you'd like to contact us off the air for investment advice, we actually give that to people of high net worth, portfolio management. The voicemail locally at 254-947-1111 or 800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, find our podcasts, contact us through the Contact Us form. I know, who named that? And email directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, thank you very much for sitting through this performance. And thanks for listening to The Personal Wealth Coach.